Well, good afternoon to you, everybody. Welcome aboard and happy summer to you. By golly, about 5:30 this morning, summer rolled in. We gave spring the boot and a big salute to good old summertime. I hope you were able to join us yesterday on our All Request and Dedication program here on KLBB between noon and 2. We dedicated the entire 2 hours to playing listeners' favorite summer songs, songs with summer in the title or summer prominently figuring in the lyrics. We had so many requests that we could have done 5 hours yesterday, and we're going to carry over a lot of the songs to Monday and Tuesday next, too. So I erred there. I should have carved out at least an extra hour or two yesterday, because you folks are so good when it comes to summer songs. Summer music is just feel-good music, isn't it? Absolutely so. So here we are, first day of summer, already at 77 humid degrees. Kyle, you were out there a bit ago. Muggy, huh? A little close?
Yeah, it's kind of warm.
Yeah. You're the master of understatement there, my boy. Well, I'm thinking up along the North Shore, things were a tad cooler. The running of Grandma's Marathon today, this morning, they started out early. We have not, at least I have not, been able to find any unofficial winners yet. Probably some folks from Kenya. They always seem to win that one. We'll find out a little bit later about that. But, yeah, the running was probably, in all likelihood, a lot cooler along the North Shore. They start from up there by Two Harbors and then run all the way down to Duluth to Grandma's Saloon and Deli down there at Canal Park. So hope everybody had a good run up there. And Kyle, you were away. Kyle is our producer and board operator here. Did I identify myself? Stan Turner here. Maybe that's where you can send all the complaints to. That's me. You were gone here last week. You're getting married. Kind of a bachelor's getaway. Was that the deal?
Yeah. I mean, we stayed in town and that, but we just, you know, went out to dinner and kind of went to a couple of bars. It was pretty low-key, but it was nice.
Well, tell the folks what you had planned, though. You were going to do, what do you call that?
Originally, we had planned on going to play paintball.
Paintball.
Yes.
Is that like splat ball? Is that where you use those paint guns?
Yeah.
Does that hurt when you get hit?
A little bit.
I trust you wear head and eye protection.
Oh, yeah. You've got a full mask so that it protects your face and your eyes. You know, if you get hit in the face with those masks, they've got air holes, so you're still going to get some paint on you, but it's not going to just hit you straight in the face.
But it's important work, isn't it, Kyle, to do that?
Oh, yeah.
And you don't want to wear your best suit, do you?
No, absolutely not.
All right.
You might be able to get it clean, but it's going to take some work.
Maybe it was a blessing, Kyle, that you couldn't do that.
Yeah, maybe.
There could have been some injuries, some battle wounds there. Anyway, welcome back, everybody. Here we go. Let's get on with the show. So what's going on in the world? Or more to the point, what in the world is going on? Yes, it's time again for us to use this noon hour airtime to clear the air. You know, blow away the fog and confusion. See just what our elected and appointed leaders and those who want to be our leaders are really up to. And that means we must utter those dreaded G and P words, government and politics. Please don't go running from your radio right now. No, no, no. We're not about to turn this into some mind-numbing seminar on governments. Nope. We want to give you some plain language, straight talk on what and who is affecting our lives right now. In other words, what the heck is going on at the state and national level, and what does it all mean to our lives? The master of straight talk and plain language with a gift for knowing what's going on and why is David Schultz. David is a regular guest on this program, our explainer-in-chief or leading clarifier. David is professor of just about everything at Hamline University in St. Paul. David, welcome back. I'm glad you your wife drove you here to get through the traffic melee downtown here. I'm glad you got in okay.
Yeah, no problem whatsoever. It's a good day. Everybody's out, of course, and so so she dropped me off, and she's off wandering around looking at the town.
You and your wife were at the Strawberry Patch this morning, weren't you?
We are. We were at a place called the Berry Patch in Scandia.
Yep.
Beautiful place. We've been going there for about 20 years, and we picked 30 pounds of strawberries this morning.
Kyle, do you see any strawberry? Did he bring any up here?
I didn't see any.
No. Well, darn absent-minded professors.
That's what it is.
David, I said you're a professor of everything. Your main academic focus at Hamline, and you're at other schools, too. What is it?
I'm a professor of political science at Hamline University, and I also teach in the law school at the University of Minnesota, and political science, of course, but I also teach, among other subjects, election law.
Okay, election law. There are laws governing elections.
There are, and people forget about that. I mean, it wasn't until Florida 2000, where all the controversy surrounded the Bush versus Gore race, yeah. that we realized that there's an entire framework of law out there that governs who gets to vote, who gets to run, how do we count ballots, and basically how we run elections. And Minnesota, of course, remembers that from the fact that back when Franken and Coleman back in, you know, quite a few years ago, when they had their race, we had that recount that dragged out for 6 months. And then also with Emmer and Dayton 4 years ago, we had a very close race. And so we seem to be the state that has some very, very close races in the last few years. And because of that, you know, we have come to understand things such as the complexity of election law in terms of rules, again, that determine, again, who gets to vote, how we get to count ballots, and so forth.
Okay. Well, it happens that Minnesota has a primary election coming up, August the 12th, I think is the date.
That's correct.
We want to kind of handicap this or at least talk about what's going on here. We have a U.S. Senate race, and that's pretty much uncontested. But for governor, this ought to be interesting because Mark Dayton, the DFL incumbent, stands all alone. He's unopposed. But on the GOP side, they're looking more like Democrats all the time, aren't they?
Yeah,
fighting
was
themselves.
Remember that old Will Rogers line? I think it was they asked him if he was a member of any organized party, and he said, no, I'm a Democrat.
Exactly.
That's right.
Pretty well summed it up. Well, the Republicans, at least at this level and maybe at the national level, are looking a lot like that these days.
Right.
Republicans used to have a pretty orderly political house, you know.
That's right.
It was kind of a gentlemanly thing where you stand aside if somebody gets endorsed, but no longer the case here.
Right. There used to be the great Ronald Reagan line. Ronald Reagan used to be famous for saying, he was famous for that too, but he had what he called the 11th commandment, which was, thou shalt not speak ill of any fellow Republican.
Right, right.
And basically that captures exactly what you were saying, is that the Republicans used to be a highly organized...
Disciplined.
A good phrase, a disciplined party. And clearly at the national level, we've seen in the last few years with the rise of the Tea Party, we see it pulled in one direction. We see it being pulled even within the Tea Party in a couple directions. The very conservative wing of the party is pulled between the Ted Cruz's on one level versus the Rand Paul's on another level. We have a different pull of the party, which are the social conservatives. And then we have a different part of the party, if I can describe it, which is sort of the party of Mitt Romney, Chris Christie, which is more sort of the old establishment Republican Party. So you've got several different factions within the Republican Party all sort of trying to gain dominance. And that's getting played out also in the state of Minnesota in terms of being how it's being pulled in a variety of different directions. We have, you know, looking at our list here, you know, I would say we have somebody like Marty Seifert, for example, who opted basically not to go by the party's endorsement, who represents what I call sort of the old Norm Coleman, the Tim Pawlenty wing of the party, a little bit more moderate.
Yes.
You've got Scott Honor, who has basically opted not even to go to the convention, has said, I'm just going to run as a wealthy business person. Kurt Zellers, former Speaker of the House, who's somewhere a little bit more conservative, and then Jeff Johnson, who fits in somewhere, again, also on that more conservative direction. And so you've got all these different pulls within the Republican Party, and that's why it's playing out the way it's going to for August 12th, that we've got, you know, several different candidates all representing different constituencies of the Republican Party who all want to run against Mark Dayton.
And that means that the Republicans have a four-way contest for governor in the August 12th primary here in Minnesota.
Does.
Jeff Johnson, you mentioned, he's the endorsed candidate.
Right.
You mentioned Kurt Zellers, former Speaker of the Minnesota House. Marty Seifert was a Republican leader in the State House of Reps,
too. I think he might have been Assistant Majority Leader at one time.
Now, Marty, interestingly, stepped aside last time around when Emmer got the nod, the official endorsement. This time around, Seifert is not. He said, I'm going to go for it in the primary. And this has become a trend in both major parties here. What about, David, Professor, what about the endorsement system? Is it a dinosaur? Is its day done? Are we pretty much, these folks are kind of making a mockery of it now.
Well, there's a great routine in Sesame Street.
When in doubt, go back to Sesame
Street.
That's
right. In Sesame Street, there's a routine, and you might remember it too, where it says, which of these objects doesn't belong? And they show you a whole bunch of different objects. I don't know if any listeners remember that. Okay. Anyhow, I sometimes say, we have in this state a caucus, a convention, and a primary. Which one doesn't fit here? And it may be increasingly that perhaps now the conventions don't fit at this point. Because what's happened, and we've seen this both with the Democrats and Republicans, is that the people who show up at the caucuses and conventions represent a more narrow spectrum, maybe either more conservative or more liberal than the rest of the party. These are the...
Well, they're the zealots, the activists.
These are the zealots.
They show up.
That's right. And Woody Allen once said 90% of life is showing up. Or conversely, Garrison Keillor once said, democracy is a great form of government for people who have too much time on their hands. But either case, that it's not necessarily clear how representative these people at the conventions are, evidenced by the fact that going back about 20 to 25 years now for both parties, that the endorsed candidates at conventions rarely are the ones to win at the primary. And so there are powerful incentives for candidates at this point to say, I'm going to bypass the convention, go directly to the primary, which in the case of Zellers and Scott Honor, that's what they're going to do. Or Marty Seifert, who originally went to the convention and then said, well, gosh, I didn't get the nomination. I am now going to go on straight and run in the primary.
A former state Republican Party chair, Pat Shortridge, put it this way, apropos of what you're saying. It's my long-held belief that primaries make superior candidates. Wow, is that a slap in the face of endorsement.
Right, and it does for two reasons. Yeah. First, it picks somebody who's been battle-tested. Battle-tested in the sense of having been vetted through debates, having been vetted through having to fundraise, articulate your positions before a broader crowd. And then the second thing that it really does is ensures that you're going to have a candidate, hopefully, that'll represent the broader spectrum of your party. Mm-hmm. Now, what's going to be fascinating this time here, with four candidates on the ballot, theoretically, the winning candidate could get 26% of the primary vote and win the primary. Now, I don't think it's going to be that. If I were making a prediction, looking at my crystal ball, I think somebody will win in the mid to upper 30s. Mm-hmm, maybe 40%, but I doubt it. Let's say mid to upper 30s. That still means, by my estimate, approximately 60% to two-thirds of the Republicans didn't vote for that person.
Wow.
And so the challenge is going to be, after August 12th, of how do you now get the rest of the party behind you and pivot very quickly to run in an election. The other challenge here is a couple things about the primary. First is that they can spend less time between now and August 12th going after Mark Dayton, and they have to go after one another. Now, they've all said they're not going to...
That means money spent.
That's right, money spent. They're going to squander what little money they have going after one another. Now, they all saying that they're not going to attack one another. You're laughing like I am.
Yeah.
Tight campaign. They're going to go after one another some point. Now, and so they're going to spend a lot of time going after one another, wasting their money going after one another, and then they're going to have to get united very quickly after that. Now, I throw another variable to think about here. Okay, now I got this wrong 4 years ago, and I'm willing to admit this. Okay. 4 years ago was our first ever August primary. Mm-hmm. Now, we had to move our primary to August because of federal law that requires that our general election ballots be mailed out 45 days in advance of the general election so that they reach our troops overseas.
Oh, yes.
And that's perfectly legitimate. Mm-hmm. Perfectly legitimate, which has pushed our primary back to August. Now, I predicted 4 years ago, looked at what other states did, that we'd have about a 10 or 11% turnout. I was wrong. It was about 15 or 16%, partly because the Democrats had a very heated battle for the gubernatorial nomination. I don't think we're going to see that 15 or 16% again this time. I'm willing to say probably about 12 or 13% turnout.
Wow.
So we're looking at an election where, think about it, most people aren't thinking about voting the second week of August.
Mm-hmm.
I always say that the campaign season in Minnesota starts where? At the state fair.
Yep.
That's true. People show up. They get to press the flesh of the candidates.
Right.
And so you're not going to give a very big turnout in August. Mm-hmm. And so whoever wins this, remember, is going to probably win when an electorate of about 12%.
Wow.
Split between Republicans and Democrats. Mm-hmm. And whoever gets that is then only going to get probably about 35%. So 35% of approximately, let's say for the Republicans, of that 12% might be about 7%. So 35% of 7% of the electorate gets you the Republican nomination.
Do you care to hazard a guess on who wins in the Republican primary for governor? Johnson, Zellers, Seifert, or Honor? What would you guess at this point?
Boy, that's a tough one. Yeah. Right now, Johnson has the endorsement. He has the party machinery able to help him. Right. I would say he probably has a slight nod, although I think at this point the polls put Zellers in the lead, mm-hmm. very closely followed by Marty Seifert. I really think this is a wide open one at this point.
All right.
And so my crystal ball is not as clear as it could be.
Okay. Let's look at the Democratic side before we break here, talking about, and again, we don't want to turn this into a political science seminar here, and we're not. We're talking about things that affect you, ladies and gentlemen, directly here, because whomever winds up winning these races is going to have an impact on all of our lives. Now, on the Democratic side, Rebecca Otto is the endorsed candidate, right,
for state auditor.
She's an incumbent, so she's already in office. But along at the last minute...
Last hour.
Well, how about last minute, David?
I think it was last minute.
Last 30 seconds, Kyle. Along comes Matt Intenza, a Democrat, a former member of the legislature. And there he is, challenging the endorsed candidate of his own party. And now you've got the DFL chairman, Ken Martin, and the sitting governor, Mark Dayton, saying, tut, 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 you shouldn't do that.
That's right.
And it's interesting that Mark Dayton would say that, because he was escorted off the DFL convention floor 4 years ago because he was not the endorsed candidate. He didn't have proper credentials to be there.
That's right.
He bucked the system and won the election without the endorsement.
Yeah.
Now he's counseling people to mind yourself and follow the endorsement. So,
well, I guess it changes your perspective when you're the endorsed candidate, I guess.
That's not a knock on Dayton. It's just a statement of fact.
But it's interesting because two things quickly. First, most people really don't know what the state auditor does. And what the state auditor does is actually audit the local governments in the state of Minnesota. This is a nerd bean counting job. But
Go ahead and say it.
And I say that because I have enormous respect for mm-hmm. the people who've been the auditors over the years.
Okay.
But the auditor's position has also been a gateway for the governorship.
It's a big launching pad, isn't it? To higher office.
Arne Carlson did it.
Yep.
Mark Dayton did it too. Mm-hmm. And so, but this is going to be interesting because usually it's a relatively sleepy race. Not a lot of profile. Not a lot of money is raised on this one. But Matt Intenza is a millionaire. He has a lot of money, and he can dump an incredible amount of money into this race. And that, I think, is the real challenge because Rebecca Otto, who by all accounts has done a quite good job in this position, probably wasn't prepared for, at least initially, the amount of money that Intenza might be able to bring to the race. Yeah. But what was fascinating is that after he decided at the last minute to announce he was going to run, you're right, the Democrats came to his side. Ken Martin criticized. Mm-hmm. And what I've heard is that she's raised quite a bit of money in the interim since.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting.
Okay, the machine's getting behind her for sure.
It is.
Huh?
It is.
Okay,
question,
all right.
Question.
David Schultz, Professor David Schultz of Hamline University, our great explainer here, the expert on politics, both local, state, and national. Lovely to have him here again. We always enjoy our conversation with David, the great clarifier. He blows away the fog here. Thank you, David. We're going to take a break here, come back. We've got lots more to chew on, stuff that does affect you, ladies and gentlemen, so please stay with us.
On Friday, June 27th at 8 p.m., Jaime's Haberdashery presents Jaime's Ole Opry. Classic country, live in-store at Jaime's Haberdashery, celebrating a decade in downtown St. Paul. Tickets are available in-store for just $35. Hors d'oeuvres, wine, cheese, live classic country music at Jaime's Haberdashery, downtown St. Paul, June 27th. The suit, the shirt, the tie. And on June 27th, Jaime's Ole Opry at Jaime's Haberdashery, downtown St. Paul.
At the Stan Turner Show, we love good stories, and there's no better place to find them than Valley Bookseller in downtown Stillwater. Valley Bookseller is an independent bookstore with knowledgeable and friendly staff who love books. Tell them what you like to read, and they'll make terrific recommendations just for you. Also, discover one of the finest children's collections in the entire Twin Cities. Valley Bookseller. Great books, great people. 217 North Main in Stillwater. Online at valleybookseller.com.
What has 10 standard airbags, gets 38 miles per gallon, and comes equipped with a high-powered and responsive 1.4 V4 engine? Oh, yeah. And one more thing. It's just $99 a month. The 2014 Chevy Cruze from Stillwater Motors. Lease it today for just $99 a month, or about $3.33 a day. That's less than the price of 1 gallon of gas. The Chevy Cruze. Superb handling. Lots of get up and go. Great gas mileage. It looks great with a full warranty. And for a limited time, lease it for just $99 a month. Take a test drive and choose from more than 45 Chevy Cruzes in stock at Stillwater Motors. Highway 36 and Stillwater Boulevard. Right on the corner. Right on the price and online at stillwatermotors.com. Radunn's family owned and operated since 1922.
Stillwater Motors. Good people to know.
We are back here. Thank you very much for your company this beautiful first day of summer here. It's just a delight. It's a bit muggy out there. That's not a complaint, just an observation. We're at around the high 70s already and maybe shooting for the high 80s before the day is out. So it's here, folks. Get out and enjoy it if you can. And Kyle, thank you very much for turning up the AC in the studio here. David and I are just about wilting on the vine here. So
you
may have saved the show. Thank you. David Schultz, Professor David Schultz of Hamline University is here today. We are talking about, well, he's kind of a doctor, a political doctor. We're looking at the body politic right now,
that's
aren't
right.
we? See what see what condition the condition is in, as the old rock song
that's
goes.
That's right.
Well, here we have an interesting piece here. We've been talking about party endorsements, whether they're worth a darned or not anymore. Apparently, the parties, I don't know. This could become a dinosaur endorsement. We'll see what happens. But an interesting story on the Minnesota Republican front today. The state Republican Party is standing behind its endorsed candidate for Minnesota Supreme Court. There is a seat up there. I think it's held by David Lillehog
yes.
right now, the incumbent justice. And it turns out, unbeknownst to the state party chairman, and I guess most if not all of the delegates at the state Republican convention, endorsing convention, that the candidate for the U.S. Minnesota Supreme Court is charged with drunken driving and resisting arrest. Last year sometime. Innocent until proven guilty. Let's say that right
yes,
now.
Correct.
There's been no trial yet. The candidate is Michelle McDonald, and she protests her innocence and all the rest, so that'll let the trial take care of that. But nonetheless, the party is standing behind her. What do you think about that?
Well, it's surprising that something like this didn't come out sooner.
It is.
Right.
It is.
Now, nobody is perfect, as far as I know. None of us should live in glass houses.
True enough.
However, when it comes to running for a Supreme Court justice, we probably apply different standards of conduct than we do for regular candidates for office, and expecting them to be probably come clean regarding, do we have any outstanding convictions or not in this case, you know, any outstanding sort of legal troubles coming down the line, I think is important. I'm a law professor also.
Yes.
And I was going to say is that when my students take the bar, to be able to admit it to practice law in the state of Minnesota and across the country, there's an ethical component. And we can have a lot of great jokes about lawyers and ethics, but actually it's a profession that's heavily regulated in terms of ethics. And if they don't list, for example, all of their outstanding tickets that they've received, for example, with speeding tickets and that, not listing one of those, but even if you forgot, could be a reason not to admit you to practice law. And so I say that because the standard to be admitted to practice law is an exceedingly high standard. And now to run for office, for somebody not to have told anybody and said, well, yeah, I got arrested for drunk driving and resisting arrest, and I have a trial coming up at some point, that's something that should have been said at some point, the party should have looked into her background to do a better job vetting.
Okay.
And so I suspect at some point, either they stand behind this candidate and she goes down in a flame of glory or lack thereof, or enough pressure is mounted that she's going to have to step aside.
Okay.
And I don't know which it's going to be, but clearly, you know, if she's trying to take on an incumbent, which is hard to win to start that for all the stories about her to be all about the fact that she's got a pending DUI and a resisting arrest, not good for getting your message out.
Okay. David, I think it was the Watergate scandal. The line, it might have come from the so-called deep throat informant, Mark Felt, the FBI guy who was feeding information surreptitiously to Bob Woodward. Follow the money. follow the money. That was it. And, you know, that applies to politics more than ever now. The money, in many cases, determines who's up, who's down. It really does. The parties, let's take the Minnesota Democratic and Republican parties right now. They're not exactly rolling in cash, especially the Republican Party. They were bankrupt. They were barely able to pay their office rent a couple of years ago. In bad, bad trouble. They're trying to rebuild right now. And a lot of rank-and-file Republicans are not very happy with what they've seen, so they have to win those people back, too.
Right.
So there's a big money crunch. The thing is, though, a lot of the money is no longer coming from traditional sources. It's coming from big sources outside the state of Minnesota, right?
Right,
and
right.
This leads me to want to ask you about this U.S. Supreme Court decision a couple of years ago. It's known as Citizens United. You know the one, don't you?
Right.
Versus Federal Election Commission.
Yes.
May I just read? This is what you'd expect, a liberal slant from the New York Times op-ed page. But this is what the New York Times op-ed writer said after that decision came down about 4 years ago. With a single disastrous, I'm quoting here, with a single disastrous 5-4 ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court has thrust politics back to the robber baron era of the 19th century, disingenuously waving the flag of the First Amendment. The court's conservative majority has paved the way for corporations to use their vast treasuries to overwhelm elections and intimidate elected officials into doing their bidding. The op-ed piece goes on to say, oh, by the way, this decision also allows unions to do the same thing. So, okay, in the interest of fairness, what about this decision? What does it mean for financing elections and electing candidates?
Well, what it's meant is if we now look at the numbers, that was a 2010 decision, if I remember correctly. If we look at what we've now learned after 3 years, what it has really done is dramatically increased the amount of third-party spending in the United States. And in some situations, some of that spending has gone up by over 1,000%, a tenfold amount. Now, think about, I'm going to do a very rough distinction here, okay? Three ways how money or where money comes in. Candidates can have money for their own campaign. Parties can help candidates out, and then there are third-party groups, you know, that can spend money. Now, what we've really seen, especially as a result of Citizens United, it doesn't free up corporations to directly give money to candidates yet. We're going to talk about that in a second here. That's still not legal, but it's made it possible for corporations and unions, but corporations far, far outspend unions. It makes it possible for corporations to be able to put unlimited amounts of money into political action committees, into what's called super PACs, into even into nonprofit organizations that in many situations can surreptitiously spend phenomenal amounts of money, unregulated amounts of money to affect the political process. And we've seen that already. We've already seen, again, a dramatic explosion of hundreds of percent, if not thousands of percent, in terms of when the money is being spent. And what that does is, of course, deter certain candidates from running. Most of our listeners here, I doubt, could afford to run for office simply because of how expensive it's gotten. Additionally, what it's done now is really has tilted the scales. It has really tilted the scales to favor big donors, big contributors to this process. Add that to also another decision that was just issued just a few months ago, the McCutchinson decision, which is also equally important to understand. And what one of the Watergate reforms passed after Watergate said that there was a cap on how much money you could give to any particular candidate for federal office. Now it's roughly $2,300. But then it overall imposed an overall cap on how much money you could give to all federal candidates in political action committees. As of this year, it's roughly $123,000. What the Supreme Court did this year was to strike down the overall limit on what's called aggregate contribution limits. Phrased another way, what the court said is that your First Amendment right to free speech was violated because you could not spend more than $123,000in federal campaigns. And so, I don't know about you.
A free speech issue?
Free speech issue.
On spending money.
The court has, I think the court has gotten it fundamentally wrong from the beginning in equating money with speech. And it's what the court has said yet again here. And so what we're in the position of now seeing is where individuals can now give unlimited amounts of money to as many candidates at the federal level. I rephrase it. They can give up to $2,300 to every candidate running for federal office in the United States if you wanted to. And so overall aggregate limits are out at this point. Now, certainly, and I'm looking at what you're holding in your hand here, certainly money isn't the be-all, end-all of everything, but money usually makes a huge difference in terms of what it can do, in terms of buying access time, in terms of all the privileges that it gives to donors and to the candidates who have the money.
Well, David, do you think that money played a role in the demise, the political demise of Eric Cantor in the state of Virginia? Here's the U.S. House Republican Majority Leader getting knocked off by a candidate, and he, to the surprise of just about, it's almost like Oberstar getting knocked over in the 8th District here. Almost unthinkable, but it's happened. Supposedly immigration, that was an issue that worked against Mr. Cantor. I don't know about that, but what's your take on this? Does this signal a resurgence of the Tea Party, or what does it mean?
Okay, well, first off, I am always hesitant to generalize from one race in one primary to the rest of the United States.
I'm with you.
Every political analyst out there wants to say this is a harbinger of something to come.
Yeah.
In many cases, it's one race, one primary, one exception. Okay, now, I actually like the parallel that you were drawing here in terms of thinking about, does it tell us first something about the resurgence of the Tea Party? It tells us something about the Tea Party perhaps in that district, but it tells us something about, and I will do a parallel here, to Jim Oberstar. I think what Jim Oberstar lost was for a very simple reason, complacency. Complacency. He took it for granted that he was going to win, and he took it for granted that people were going to vote for him. And Eric Cantor fell to the same ill, is that he basically took it for granted that he was going to win, and as majority leader, majority leader, he's worried about the rest of the country and not just his own district.
He was on track maybe to become Speaker of the House.
He was next in line.
Yeah,
big deal. Yeah, there's a great story I got to tell here. It's a Tip O'Neill story. He wrote a book once called Speaker of the House. And he talks about...
Democrat.
And when he first ran for office, he ran for, just for a little bit of trivia here, the congressional seat office that he ran for was the one that a guy named JFK used to hold. If anybody remembers him.
Okay.
So anyhow, it was a couple days before the election, and he went across the street to talk to this older woman who he had known for years, and he said, "I hope you vote for me on election day." And she said, "Yes, but I'm glad that you asked." And what Tip O'Neill put in his book, and he said, always ask for their vote. Never take it for granted that they're going to vote for you. Jim Oberstar was guilty of that, and Eric Cantor, I would argue, was equally guilty of that. He took it for granted that he was going to win, that he had the votes, and he neglected to go and ask people for their vote.
I think there's a lot of truth in that. There's another way to come at that, too. Lindsey Graham, Senator Graham from next door in South Carolina, he fended off a Tea Party challenge successfully, and he was asked, why did Cantor go down? And he said, "I don't think Eric got beat because of his stand on immigration. I think he got beat because his lack of definition or defining himself on immigration. He wasn't around to explain himself." Maybe
that
fits into what you're saying.
I think that's part of it. I think part of what also happens too is, again, in the what I call the rules of politics, one of my rules of politics is define or be defined. Either you define who you are and define the other side, or they're going to do it to you. And the best example I will give of that is back in 2004 when John Kerry, three Purple Hearts, if I remember correctly, was defined as a traitor and as a coward when they swift voted him. To me, if you can take somebody who's won three Purple Hearts and make them sound like a traitor, that's an amazing thing to do. I'm not saying I like that, but
I understand what you're saying.
He refused to define himself and got defined as something else.
Well, interesting stuff here. We're going to take another break here. We want to talk about many other things affecting Minnesota, Wisconsin. In fact, there is an issue bubbling around Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, we want to talk about. And we're talking about definitions. And I'm going to ask you again, Professor, for a definition of the Tea Party. Let's just try to define that here when we come back, okay?
Good.
Let's do that. We'll be right back with Professor David Schultz. Stay with us.
On Friday, June 27, at 8 p.m., Jaime's Haberdashery presents Jaime's Ole Opry. classic country, live in-store at Heine's Haberdashery, celebrating a decade in downtown St. Paul. Tickets are available in-store for just $35. Hors d'oeuvres, wine, cheese, live classic country music at Heine's Haberdashery, downtown St. Paul, June 27th. The suit, the shirt, the tie. And on June 27th, Heine's Ole Opry at Heine's Haberdashery, downtown St. Paul.
To really experience a book, meet the author. I'm Stan Turner for Valley Bookseller in downtown Stillwater. Every month, Valley Bookseller's calendar is loaded with events featuring both local and national authors. Visit valleybookseller.com and click the events calendar for a complete list. Choose from monthly events like the Totally Criminal Cocktail Hour or special presentations with authors on tour. Meet your favorite author at Valley Bookseller. Great books, great people. 217 North Main in Stillwater.
An historic fine dining restaurant experience awaits you at the Orchard of Baldwin, just east of the Twin Cities in Baldwin, Wisconsin. Not only do they have nightly dinner specials and an amazing Sunday brunch, but did you know it is also one of the area's largest and busiest wedding facilities? If you have a son or daughter getting married, have them stop by for lunch or dinner and meet the staff. Have them look around and see this historic facility with its rustic elegance and charm. For more information, check them out at theorchardofbaldwin.com. That's theorchardofbaldwin.com.
Most folks know Oak Marsh as a beautiful 18-hole golf course, but you may not realize that Oak Marsh also has first-class banquet facilities and restaurant. If you're planning a wedding, reception, banquet, or just want a great lunch, dinner, or golf outing, the restaurant and banquet facilities at Oak Marsh are the ideal choice. Oak Marsh has three beautiful rooms to choose from, a professional staff, and a delicious menu. So skip the hassle and cleanup and plan your next party at Oak Marsh Golf Course, just off I-94 and Inwood in Oakdale, Minnesota.
We are back here. Stan Turner with you here. We're examining the body politic, and who better to call in than Dr. Really. Professor David Schultz. Well, he's a doctor. A PhD, right. That's for
PhD,
sure.
Post-hole
digger, isn't that what that's
post-hole digger, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah,
actually,
that's it.
actually, one of my friends used to say, piled higher and deeper.
Well, we're shoveling a bit today, aren't we?
We are shoveling today.
Every time you wade into politics and government, you're going to sometimes get in over your head. But we're helping us clarify things here. I asked you for a definition of the Tea Party. We throw that label around here. Is it, in fact, a sector of the Republican Party? Does it stand apart from the Republican Party? Is it divided within itself? What is it?
Well, first off, by saying that I think it started off as a protest movement that became a social movement that has become now a political movement that's trying to take over the Republican Party. So it's kind of grown. And it's gone in a different direction than perhaps the Occupy Wall Street on the left, you know, which started off as a protest, tried to become a social. It's kind of fizzled out.
Right.
Now, the Tea Party has a variety of positions of which I don't think are completely coherent. You know, for example, they're against government spending and against government taxes. But on the other hand, many Tea Party people say that they don't want the government to touch their Medicare or their Social Security, quintessential government programs. They seem to be against immigration. They seem, depending on who they are, some of them seem to still be against same-sex marriage. Depending on who you talk to at this point, some of the Tea Party people are against government intervention in Iraq and other places around the world. But
sound like libertarians, some of them, in a way, right?
So there's a libertarian wing of the party, and then there may be some of them who are a little bit more social conservative, but it's not a completely, I'd say, coherent ideology. I mean, one of my undergraduate political science professors, Jim Yong, who just back east, who passed away, once argued and said that, you know, American politics doesn't usually rise to the level of grand political theories. We've got sort of ideologies. We got some kind of oftentimes incoherent positions put together. So the Tea Party, I would describe it as anti-federal government, anti-tax, anti-immigration, wanting to perhaps pay down the government debt. It's there, but I'd say it's more a protest movement, more defined to what it's opposed to than defining what it's in favor of.
But it's a significant player, isn't it?
It's a significant player in the Republican Party.
Right.
It clearly was a huge player in 2010 across the United States. that Sarah Palin, I think at that point, was the poster child or the face. Mm-hmm. She's somewhat faded from it. I think now you have Ted Cruz from Texas. You've got Rand Paul from Kentucky, as I would say, are the major faces for the Tea Party movement right now.
All right. Let's take a look at something the Associated Press ran today nationwide. The report out of Washington by AP reporter Thomas Beaumont says, first it was Chris Christie, humbled by members of his staff, who impeded access to a bridge from New Jersey into Manhattan.
Not just a bridge. This is the George Washington.
The George Washington Bridge.
This is the granddaddy of all bridges.
All right. In an apparent act of political retribution. Apparent act. Okay. Now, AP says, it's Scott Walker, who prosecutors in Wisconsin believe acted criminally by coordinating the fundraising and spending of outside conservative groups. May we hasten to say that the governor has not been charged. He says this is baloney. It's all smoke. There's nothing to it. And he's going to skate out of this controversy unblemished. Okay, we want to make sure we're fair on this because this is still a developing story. David, what's your take on this?
Well, this...
He's up for re-election this year.
He's up for re-election. This, first of all, there are state and federal laws that make it illegal for candidates to coordinate their spending with political parties and with interest groups, political action committees. That's well established at the federal level, and more importantly, that's well established in the state of Wisconsin. There were prosecutors investigating him for this. There were a couple of federal judges who basically halted the prosecution, claiming that some of the laws in place didn't apply to Scott Walker. This is being appealed by the prosecutors at this point. On one level, Walker is not denying necessarily that this coordination existed. He's merely saying at this point that either he's not been indicted or that those laws don't apply to what he was actually doing. And so the question is going to be at this point, who wins on this one? Do the prosecutors win on appeal? And if so, are they going to be able to basically go back and continue the investigation? Because what was highly unusual in this case is that a judge basically ordered prosecutors to stop a criminal investigation. That almost never, ever occurs. And so this is very unusual.
To give Walker his due again, Walker defended himself just yesterday in a TV interview. Quote, this is not news. This is not new news, said Walker. It's just newly released. Documents were opened, he says, but no charges. Case over, he said on Fox News. Walker said there was, quote, no doubt that he's being attacked unfairly, much in the same way Christie in New Jersey was earlier this year. So just to make sure we give Mr. Walker's rejoinder, or rebuttal to that. Okay,
right, correct.
All right, there we are. Let's get back to some other things right here. We have a U.S. Senate contest in this state this year. Al Franken, DFL incumbent, what kind of shape is he in, David?
He
squeaked through last time, didn't he? Both he and Dayton just kind of...
He had 312 vote
lead. Landslide Al.
Landslide Al. And people may have already forgotten that originally on election night that Norm Coleman, the incumbent, was ahead by several hundred votes. Yep. It took 6 months, long recounts and litigation, and finally a Supreme Court decision upheld the 312 vote victory. Now, put a 6 years later, Al Franken has a lot of money in the bank, incredible lot of money in the bank, and he has respectable approval ratings. Now, last time he got 42% of the vote, 312 vote victory. His approvals, depending on which poll you look at, his approval ratings are somewhere in the upper 40s to about 50%. And again, I've seen a couple of different polls in different areas. And
you got to do at least 50, don't you, as an incumbent, huh?
50 you have to do. Yeah. 50 you have to do, but not in bad shape. Actually, quick sidebar here. Okay. I know you have Gail Rosenblum on the show once in a while.
We do.
And I did a story with her in the Pioneer Press, the Star Tribune, a few months ago, and we were talking about approval ratings. And I said, politics is the only place that I know that if only half the people hate you, you're doing well.
Kyle, that makes sense, doesn't it?
That's right. In our private life, if 50% of the people who knew us didn't like us, it would not be good. And so he's at about only with half the people not liking him, which is not too bad at this point. And so he's in, I would say, fair shape. What's working to his benefit is the fact that that up until recently, the Republicans didn't unite behind anybody. They now have Mike McFadden,
right,
who for all intents and purposes is facing a primary against Representative Jim Abler. Mm-hmm. But McFadden has an incredible amount of money. He can self-finance himself at this point. Mm-hmm. Now, what becomes critical to think about with this race is, again, polls right now have Franken anywhere between 6 to 8 points up, depending on margins of errors. Mm-hmm. Not bad, not a huge margin, but what's more important here is the fact that no national analyst, you know, in terms of looking at this race, puts this one as a vulnerable race, you know, that they're all saying at least leans Democrat or strongly Democratic. Charlie Cook of the Cook Political Report says that. Now, the reason why this is important is that the Republicans want to take back the U.S. Senate. They need to win six seats to take...
Want to ask you about that, the likelihood of that happening.
Yeah, they want to take... They want to do six... They need six seats to take control of the U.S. Senate. They are looking... Six... If I remember, I think it's six. Yeah, six seats to do that. There are at least six other seats across the United States where Democrats are up for election or not running for re-election in states that Mitt Romney won the state 2 years ago. Those are better bet states. Now, the reason why this is important is that right now, if your main goal as a Republicans is take control of the U.S. Senate, you funnel your money into the races where you think you've got the best chance of pulling it off. Money's going to go in to oppose Mary Landrieu, for example, in places like Louisiana or in other states across the country. Only if it looks like something is changing in the state of Minnesota will we see significant outside money come in. So the reason why this is important to know here is that McFadden can fund his own campaign, but unless it looks like he's got a real chance to pull this off, don't expect to see a lot of outside money come in to supplement him. And that almost becomes a self-fulfilling cycle. So McFadden, I think, very quickly after August 12th, has to level a couple of blows against Franken to tighten it up to get money to come in.
I imagine McFadden's name recognition is way down there.
Correct.
I mean, nobody really knows who he is. I think he's a first-timer. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, Mr. McFadden said that had he not got the endorsement, he would have run in the primary.
Yes.
How about that?
That's right. Okay. Right. And so he has a lot to do in terms of defining himself at this point. Mm-hmm. And up until recently, if you went to his webpage had no statement on any issues that he had whatsoever. He is sort of running the stealth candidate without really saying what he favors or what he doesn't favor at this point. And again, if listeners go to look at his webpage even now, there's not very much on there. And so he is largely running as the wealthy candidate who doesn't like what Al Franken stands for, but he's yet to articulate what he stands for. And that's going to be important for him to do over the next few months.
Professor David Schultz with us here, examining the political landscape and the government landscape all around us, both statewide and nationally. David, I've got to ask you about the Senate race itself, the Senate itself, the U.S. Senate. It's now in Democratic hands. We don't have Nate Silver anymore. Nate Silver was the grand handicapper when it came to U.S. elections. He's now working for, I don't know, ESPN or something.
He does sports for ESPN.
Now. What's that all about? Anyway, he was uncannily accurate when calling the outcome of elections.
He was 50-50 in the last election for all the states.
Okay. Well, you be our expert this time around. What's your guess at this point on the U.S. Senate, either staying Democratic or flipping Republican?
It is, if I were assessing a probability, about 45-48% chance for the Republicans to take over the U.S. Senate. It's almost dead even, and it's not impossible. They have to pick up a lot of seats. Again, they have to pick up six seats. They have a chance to be able to do that. Democrats, on the other hand, have a chance perhaps to pick up a seat maybe in Georgia, maybe pick up a seat perhaps in Kentucky. Republicans are hoping that just simply the low approval ratings for Barack Obama, the complacency that Democrats have during non-presidential election years where they don't seem to show up to vote, and the enthusiasm of the Republicans will be enough to carry them over. I'm not sure that's a good enough of a strategy. They probably have to articulate again more what it is that they want to accomplish and not just be the party of no. And so at this point, I put their chances as slightly below 50%. But a lot's going to have to do with clearly the money, clearly the quality of the candidates that they put forth, and also what I call the narrative. What's the message that they're going to get out? But right now, it's not beyond the realm of possibility that the day after the election or so, they have control of the U.S. Senate.
You mentioned President Obama and his dismal political ratings right now. He is coming to Minnesota this coming week, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
The White House says he's coming to applaud the Minnesota for boosting the state minimum wage, which was among the lowest in the country. And now when it gets done, incremental raises, I think by 2016, it'll be, what, 9.50%, 9.5%, something like that.
Yes, right, 9.50.
Yeah, yeah. 9.50 an hour. So what about this? A lot of people are wondering, the state legislature kicked it up. Is it going to ultimately cost jobs? Are employers in Minnesota going to lay off people? Will this have, is this the law of unintended consequences, where something meant to help, especially low earners, maybe it'll cost them their jobs?
In an economics class, the received wisdom always used to be that raising the unemployment, raising the minimum wage is going to lead to less people working. That's been seriously contested over the last decade or so, that what we find is that in many situations, raising the wages, what it actually does then is put more money in people's pockets. People can spend more money on what? TVs, bread, milk, shopping, whatever they need to do. And therefore, oftentimes, it's often neutral in terms of its impact in terms of unemployment. And in fact, in some situations, there's been evidence. Alan Krueger, who was on the Council of Economic Advisors for Barack Obama, has actually done some very, very good research back when he was an economist at Princeton, and has actually found that in some cases it increases employment levels. And so it's not clear that it hurts, but there's pretty good evidence that it could very well help many people in poverty, especially get out of poverty, get a few more dollars in their pocket. And so Obama's coming because one of the issues that Democrats want to run on this year, and it's a great what's called wedge issue, is raising the minimum wage. And that public opinion polls indicate that a very large percentage, not just of Democrats, but also of independent voters, swing voters, support raising of the minimum wage. And the thing is, that's what's critical. Get the swing voter to your side.
And that leads me into my next question. In fact, I was going to ask you this. The importance of undecided or independent voters, swing voters, in elections now, both at the state and the national level. Very important, I would guess.
That's where the
betting. That's where it is.
Right. First thing is, you always want to mobilize your base, get them out to vote. But no party at the national level or at the state level has 50% plus one of the voters, and therefore the battleground is to win over those swing voters. And I will tighten it up more.
Okay.
I will tell you who those swing voters are. The single most important swing voter in Minnesota and the United States: suburban soccer moms.
Really?
They remain the most critical. The suburbs are the battleground for the control of Minnesota.
That was Republican territory.
Used to be Republican territory. And what's happened increasingly is that Republican women, especially, or former Republican women, women used to be Republican, have drifted from the party, not committed to being Democrat. They either will stay home, maybe vote Democrat, maybe vote Republican. But the battleground first is mobilizing women. Women in the suburbs, the soccer mom. Second, then it's going to be young voters. And then third, it's going to be people of color. So the real battle is capture suburban soccer moms. If you're a soccer mom out there, you're really important.
And on the national stage, Republicans have to do better attracting Hispanic votes, though.
Exactly.
Too, right? Yes.
Exactly. That's why I said people of color, because right now the Hispanics in the last presidential election, over 75% voted for Barack Obama. That contrasts to go back to when George Bush was running for office. George Bush, coming from a border state, Texas, got about 40 to 45% of Hispanic vote, and that's been eroding constantly. And many people say, and the Republican Party said this after the election a year ago, that unless they start to attract people of color, Hispanic voters, they face real difficulties.
David, you're an academic. I'm a news guy. We both love pop music, and I want you to join me on my All Request and Dedication program Monday through Friday. Or come down one of these days.
I will.
We both love the music, don't we?
Yes.
Why is it important to us? Why?
I grew up listening to AM radio, top 40. I love music. I love it.
Did you hear our summer show yesterday?
I heard it was great.
Our listeners are great. You're going to have fun with us. We'll have fun with you. So give me a date. We'll bring you down here. We'll put the politics aside. We'll put the government aside. We'll put the pop music artist center stage. How does that sound?
It's a date.
You got it, buddy. Thank you very much. Professor David Schultz, Hamline University, thanks for shedding some much-needed light on these areas today.
You're welcome,
Appreciate it. Come back soon. We'll see you. Okay, folks, thanks. Have a great weekend. Happy summer. See you on the music show Monday next. Bye-bye.